In a blood red summer, I'll give you the answer that you want is in the question that you state. That's Coheed and Cambria. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus, the question that everyone has spent 2 months and really 2 years asking might be answered by the question itself. Why isn't the Blue Jays offense good enough? Might just not be good enough. After an ugly 5-0 loss at the hands of the last place White Sox yesterday, the Jays have once again been prevented from winning 3 in a row. It's been over a month since they've done that. We do appear to be amidst that blood red summer. It's ugly. They still have a chance to win a series for the first time in a month today at Rogers Center, 7:07 start, but hard to feel too good after Garrett Crochet and the White Sox bullpen blanked the Blue Jays, 3 base runners the entire game. Joe Siddle of Blue Jay Central of the Sportsnet broadcast is here with us today to break it down. It's a 2-hour show, by the way. We're back to 2 hours every day now, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. We'll talk to Leo Morgenstern and Chris Black a little later in the show. But Joe Siddle joins us now. Joe, good morning, man. How we doing?
Good morning, Blake. I'm just looking at today's matchup, and the Blue Jays hitters get to face a pitcher making his third major league start. So everything's lined up to win a series, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Nick Nastrini, he wouldn't be the first guy up from AAA with an ERA over 5 in AAA to baffle the Blue Jays. Joe, I understand Garrett Crochet was very good yesterday. I was on with you guys on Blue Jay Central kind of breaking down why I think he's one of the most under-the-radar guys in baseball. But even acknowledging that, are you getting a little tired of the, well, tip your cap to a good pitcher side of this conversation?
Yep. You have to get tired of it. I know it's still May, but I love watching good pitching as a former catcher, and I thought Crochet was excellent last night. Of course, the high velocity that he had, and he really broke up the changeup a little more than I thought we would see. You know, we talked so much about the cutter-slider combination, but he was very good. But, yeah, you can't keep tipping your hat when you're at the bottom of Major League Baseball in hitting. And sooner or later, Blake, and you and I both know that they're going through a stretch here where they're supposedly facing weaker teams, and we know that. But there are also some pretty good pitchers on weak teams. We saw one last night. They're going to go to Detroit for 4 days, and while they are going to miss Tarek Skubal, just needs some pretty good pitching. Detroit's been pitching pretty well. They don't hit as much, but it'll be a challenge for the Blue Jays hitters. That's why I don't really love talking about strength of schedule because, you know, a pitcher like a goalie in hockey can shut a team down. And we saw it last night. But, you know, this team is going to, if you get to where you want to go, which is October baseball, guess what you're going to see? You're going to see good pitching. So somehow, some way, 1 through 9, and I always focus on the top half because those are, quote, your best hitters. You got to find a way to get to that guy. Find a way to get on base. Find a way to move a runner. Find a way to score a run or two here or there so that it's at least a game. And that's why, you know, late in that ballgame last night, it's 3-0. And if you've got a good offense and you feel good about your offense and you're in that Blue Jays dugout and you're John Schneider, you're playing this game really, we're going to scratch 1 or 2 across here. But then it forces that move. I shouldn't say force, but in move where you go to Tim Mays in the 8th inning, and that's the backbreaker because once they score 2 more, it's basically over. But you just, I don't know about you, but it just never felt like they were ever in that game because of what we've seen from the offense and because of what Crochet was doing to them.
Yeah, it's a tough one. You're facing a 14-34 team and a 3-0 deficit feels insurmountable. And again, you can acknowledge Crochet and Kopech are very nasty guys, but Brebbia has an ERA over 5. You know, this isn't the best bullpen we've ever seen. And you mentioned it. Look, they're facing the Tigers, where they're in Joe Siddle country this weekend in Detroit. And that's a team that has a 3.66 starters ERA. And you mentioned they miss Skubal, but they also miss Kenta Maeda, who's been their one bad pitcher so far. So it's not going to get, I mean, I guess on paper it can get a little easier than a Tarek Skubal. But yeah, you got to start hitting at some point. I want to talk about the Jays offense a bunch, but I did want your take on Garrett Crochet. So this is a guy who you and I talked about it yesterday. He didn't even start in college, really. He started the odd game, but he was a swingman in college. So you got to go back to high school for the last time that he started this regularly. He's already almost at a career high in innings across any level. And there is a lot of stuff there, but the results hadn't been there quite yet. He's had a good couple games here, but, you know, he entered last night with the ERA over 4. I know the White Sox don't have the most experienced catchers, but how are you calling a game for a guy like that who's got all this stuff in the world but is still learning how to pitch as a starter?
Well, I would say you're, as always, matching up against your hitters. You're using your pitcher strengths against hitters' weaknesses. And, I mean, I said it post-game, there are a handful of the hitters in the Blue Jays lineup that clearly struggle against velocity. So I'd be hammering them, and I think he did. And I'm talking mostly like about the Springers, the Turners, and believe it or not, even the Vladdy at times, right? Like, and Jensen can have trouble with the velocity, but that was next level stuff, of course, you know, coming from the left side and the way it bears in on you too. And he wasn't in all the time, but he was pretty good with it. And I thought the Turner at bat kind of really showed a lot. It was a 10 pitch at bat in the second inning, I think. And he fouled off a few fastballs, and you'd say great at bat fouling off, but I'd almost say that he's fouling off because he can't really get to it. Keeps the at-bat alive, and then he finishes it up with a 3-2 changeup away. I think it was like 91 down and away, and he did that to some other guys too, and that's pitching 101. Like, wow. I'm not sure he even needed to do that sometimes, but the fact that he did it, that makes hitting, you know, not next to impossible, but that's what made him as good as he did. As he was last night.
Yeah, there was, I really, you know, there was only one spot that I took issue with necessarily, and you and I texted about it when it happened, was the second time he faced Turner. He got behind 2-0, and, you know, there's that, he is just late on 97, and then he comes back in exactly the same spot with the cutter that's like 92, and Turner takes that for a double. That's really the only blip, I think, right? The only blemish for Crochet in terms of how he approached the Jays and how he attacked them.
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit surprising, too, to go to that pitch. Now, maybe, you know, they're trying to get that thing to get under his bat, and it didn't quite work. But to me, you're helping a guy out that showed you he wasn't getting to your mid to upper 90s there. So why help a guy out? You know, it was almost like on the other side. It was the RBI single by Nicky Lopez to make it 1-0 back in the second inning. He had just frozen. Kikuchi just frozen with a fastball. And you could just see it's a number 9 hitter. So we'd like to think, you know, lefty-lefty, that's a tough matchup. And sure, if you throw the slider away, you probably get him. And you say left it on the plate and he hits an RBI single. To the number 9 hitter in a lefty-lefty matchup, that's where I'm saying, too, I'm reading a hitter, and that fastball was, he just froze him to get, I think, to the 1-2 count. I'm coming back with it, man. I'm basically saying, here it is, hit it if you can, because by your reaction there, it didn't look like he was ready for the heat. And those are the things that I watch as a catcher, and you have to try to put in the memory bank. But if your scouting report or if your wristband says, hey, if you get ahead with 2 strikes, you'll bury him with the slider away. And again, pitch execution is everything. If he throws the slider away, he probably gets him. But there are times for me when, A, you don't have to set hitters up, and B, you can deviate from that plan sometimes and just say, let's blow him away. I think you knocked the bat out of his hands. And it looked like that a little bit later. So those are just things I like to watch for, because as a catcher, as you just said, you know, catching Crochet last night, well, yeah, it'd be a lot of fun because you've got a pitcher absolutely way more dominant than the hitters that he is facing.
Yeah, this is why, I mean, I think it's part of why there are so many catchers in baseball media, but also why guys like you and Caleb Joseph are so good at the job is, you know, being in that spot and like, yeah, the armband says this, but I just watched this hitter do this, or I read his swing from back here, and this is what I saw, and this is what I think should set him up. So Turner did get that one hit off Crochet. It was basically the only thing the Blue Jays did. It ended an 0-for-30 streak for Justin Turner. That is obviously very bad, an 0-for-30 stretch. We also have, you know, on the season, some pretty bad numbers overall against right-handed pitching. What are you seeing from Turner? You know, does it extend beyond just he can't catch up to top velocity at this point?
You know, for me, Blake, Turner and Bo are two guys. I find them hard to analyze. And the reason I say that is because they have such unique swings. Bo, with all the movement and the way he contorts his body, he can do things a lot of other guys can't. And then with Justin, it seems to be like when I first saw him, I mean, of course, we've all been watching him for years, but once he became a Blue Jay and I started looking at him a little bit, and when I say that, I mean watching his BP, watching some video, and it's, and you see him up close a little bit more, he's got a really a big forward move. And I asked him about that. It was early in the season. And he says, you know, I'm not too concerned about my forward move as long as you land almost with your center of gravity where you can still turn behind the baseball. And it made a lot of sense to me because some guys do. Like there's like Mookie Betts. There are guys that do have that forward move. But as long as you have that forward move and you're staying locked in on that backside, you can still make the move to the baseball. You know, there are a lot of hitters that almost pick up the leg and put it down. So there are different styles, and Justin's is very unique because of that big move. But as he makes that big forward move, the hands don't really go back and get to that loaded position. So I'm watching that thinking, well, he's not really getting a whole lot of separation, because then if you slow it down, you'll look, he almost literally just turns the barrel. Like, think of just turning the barrel back toward the catcher. It's almost like a flick. And I think that's why he's such a good contact hitter. He's basically saying, throw it wherever you want. I'm just going to flick this barrel out because I can put it in play. But it probably also costs him a little bit of power. And we know he has a little bit of power. He's not a home run hitter by any means. So those things that I'm referring to right there make it hard for me to think, okay, so is he, you know, I don't think he necessarily got to velocity great last year either. I don't think that's his forte. And as you get older, we know that doesn't get easier. So that can be an issue. But, the contact ability should be there. So when he's slipping like that, it just makes you wonder if something's now, is he getting a little bit more forward than normal? Because that would cost you a little bit, right? You wouldn't be able to necessarily be as perfect with your move. So a lot going on in that swing. He's a guy that's probably not panicking at all because he's been through this a million times. And that's easy to say, but anytime we see these guys, right, when they get into their mid to upper 30s, that little voice in your head saying, uh-oh, is this the time? So let's give him a little bit more run here and see, but it's certainly not a good sign because this was basically your big offensive signing this winter, right? It was kind of like almost like the Brandon Belt last year, but is it a platoon guy? Is it like that to me is not a full-time DH, right? That's a guy that's only going to do damage against lefties. So that's concerning. And this offense needs every little bit of offense it can get.
Yeah, you hope the Brandon Belt parallel that plays out here. His Belt started really poor last year too, and then turned it on. He was, their best hitter June through September, arguably. So you hope that that's happening here. Turner also a bit of a rough day at first base yesterday. Two plays that, one gets charged to Ernie Clement that Turner probably could have picked out, and then another where it was bang, bang. They maybe wouldn't have had him anyway, but he couldn't squeeze it. So something to keep an eye on there. You mentioned maybe this is, the way it's looked lately, at least, maybe this becomes more of a platoonish bat. There are obviously potential reps for Vogelbach against righties. There's also the question, Joe, that we now have to look at a little more intensely because Danny Jansen is hitting second in the order. He's caught a couple days in a row here. Are you trying to get Jansen in there at DH whenever he's not behind the plate?
Yep.
And can
yep.
you? Like, is that too much
yep.
on him as a catcher?
Yep. You have to, don't you, Blake?
I mean,
I'm not like we all can agree it's not early anymore, but we also know that good teams can come back out of holes like this. But we're not sure how good this team is. I mean, the pitching's really good, but if this offense is what it is, then you've probably dug yourself a hole you can't get out of. That's going to be an issue. So I'm throwing Danny in there every time possible. I thought it took a long time to move George out of the leadoff spot, probably a little too long. But it's done, and that's good. And is Schneider the right guy? I'm not sure. He's really prototypical leadoff hitter for me. There is some swing and miss there, but he also presents a danger when he comes to the plate. I love that. But Jano's swinging it. Jano's hot. I love him up there, too. Is that going to stay? I think we can agree probably not, right? I mean, he's really come into his own as a hitter, but what he's doing is a little off the charts right now. But, with Vladdy and Bo up there, if they can both keep doing their thing, Bo's got to get going, like really consistently. It's been better lately, but he needs to be that 800 OPS Bo Bichette, right? And we've talked about Vladdy at length, and it's been way better lately. It's been phenomenal. His at-bats have been so good. But, man, when he's not hitting balls out of the park, it's like there's this void in your lineup because that's what you expect, right? So, I mean, there are some issues. There are some issues, and that's why the more this team falls behind, you can't say, oh, the Atlanta Braves came back from whatever a couple years ago. That's a much better offense, a much better team that can come back from some struggles. This team, I'm not sure they can because of the offense that we're seeing.
Yeah, that's a team, too, that, you can look at them. You can look at the Phillies 2 years ago, look at the Diamondbacks. Those are in weaker divisions than the Blue Jays play in, too, which doesn't mean, that doesn't excuse the Jays play. It just means it's a harder road to climb back out of. With respect to the Jansen-Kirk split here, Joe, obviously Jansen's bat needs to be in there, whether it's catching two out of three and DHing the other one. What is the, how are you trying to balance the workload side of this where you do want Jansen's bat in the lineup every day? Like, obviously you could just have him catch every day, but you get him DH days so that he's not over fatigued. Kirk also, hasn't hit that well, but they love his defense behind the plate. How are you trying to shake that out this next little bit?
I think for me, it's all about Danny and what he can handle and how he feels. And I think his offense will show that, because when hitters, and I specifically catchers, and we've seen it with Alejandro Kirk, and Danny's a different animal than Kirk, but we see catchers that fatigue sets in. You know what happens is your body, you might not feel tired, but the legs just aren't working as properly. They aren't as strong. Your foundation isn't as good. Now you start using your upper body a little bit to swing, and that's when the 1-for-20 comes in, and you'll see that kind of stuff happening. So those are signs of fatigue for sure. When you see a catcher that's been swinging the bat really well, not fade off a little bit. So those will be the signs. Yes, of course you got to get Kirk in there once in a while, because Danny can't do it every day, but at the same time, let's not forget about Alejandro Kirk, that this is another bat, right? That I don't know if we were all expecting, but I think we were all saying in the offseason he's one of the culprits last year to the poor offense, like he had slipped and it needs to get back. Now, does it have to get back to being a silver slugger? No, but it just hasn't been good. And that's not good. That's another one. I mean, there are a handful of guys that that have disappeared a little bit, and that they needed that rejuvenation. And even like a Dalton Varsho, you go down the lineup a little bit more, swinging the bat really well, so you move him up. All of a sudden, ooh, maybe that's not a good spot for him. I think Dalton Varsho is Dalton Varsho. He's going to run into probably 25 this year, and everything else is probably going to be, whether he be a 720, 30 OPS kind of guy, but I don't think you can expect more and just do your other things great, but keep him down there where he belongs in that like 7 hole, and maybe he can jump a guy every once in a while. So yeah, lots to talk about, that's for sure. And you can dissect this thing 1-9, but man, if I'm the manager right now, John Schneider, it's just like you're writing names out and hoping they can run into one, and it's not happening a lot.
Yeah, I mean, this is always the thing with batting order stuff too, right? Is you're chasing your tail a little bit of who's hot right now. And then, you know, we saw last year Whit Merrifield goes up and then he immediately cools off. You know, does David Schneider cool off? Does Danny Jansen cool off? It's like you've said a bunch of times, if Bo, Vlad, and Springer aren't hitting the way that they need them to hit, the batting order is not going to matter all that much, because you're just not going to have the guys. With respect to Springer, they've talked a lot about pulling the ball in the air, and we can look at some numbers. You know, hey, in 2021, he was pulling the ball in the air like a quarter of the time. Last year, that was down to like 16%. This year, it's below 10%. What does that tell you as Springer tries to get that back to his game?
Well, when you said 2021, I was going to say that's 3 years ago when he was probably, 31 years old. It's, it's just when guys aren't doing it, there is a difference between changing your approach and using the middle of the field and thinking the other way more, as opposed to that's all I can do. Like, you can say pull the ball more, pull the ball, get it in the air more, but you don't just do that, right? Your mechanics and your bat speed and your quickness all have to be in tune. And we know, I mean, I've said it a million times, like when George Springer came to the Blue Jays, when I hear the name George Springer, I think ball's going into the left field seats, right? As a leadoff hitter. And that's who he was. And we're just not seeing it. So I don't think last year we were seeing him go the other way necessarily by design. And we're seeing it more and more too, that anytime there's some good velocity, it's hard to get to. I wasn't working on the weekend, but I think he pulled a double into the left center gap on the weekend. It was 90-something, whatever, which is great. That's good to see. But, man, you need to see a lot more of that, because that's when he's at his best, and that's when he is George Springer. And I don't know, you come into the season thinking that he's just going to be way better than he was last year after that down year. But, man, that's a pretty big assumption for a guy that's a year older, has the down year. Like, to me, the red flags had to be up, but I guess for the Blue Jays, they weren't, because they plan on bringing him back and be the leadoff hitter, right? Like, those are the things that sometimes are a little baffling to me. But, you know, when I say, could you have shored up your offense a little bit more, I think we all agreed they could have. And mind you, there's some guys out there, too, that have signed and haven't done well either. But it's just the whole point of to go totally the other way on defense. It's like, wow, that's a tough thing to do in a game where offense continues to dwindle.
Yeah, it's one thing if you take a swing at a guy and it doesn't work out, right? It's another if you don't even, you know, try to make that move, don't even try to address it. Okay, so you joked off the top a little bit. Nick Nastrini is going to start tonight. 24-year-old coming right up from AAA, an ERA of almost 6. And their ballpark's a bandbox in AAA, but it's still not terrific numbers. Well, how would you like, and this is a guy, again, by the way, a righty who throws 93-94 with a slider and then a changeup that he'll use once in a while, but mostly fastball slider to righties. How do you want to see the Jays come out against a kid like this?
Well, first and foremost, I think they're going to have a look. Like, you know, if David Schneider is leading off again tonight, and I almost feel for him a little bit. I was talking to him yesterday, I think it was, about that leadoff spot. And it's like, you know, do you feel like you have to be a bit more of a leadoff hitter? And he said, you know, I just really just try to take my same at-bats And then he stopped and paused. He said, but, you know, when you're leading up the game, you don't want to swing at the first pitch, ground out, and then because then you put the second guy in a bit of a bind. So obviously he's thinking about it, right? And that's almost too bad because you like for him to go up there with a free mind and going to be who he is. So a guy like this tonight, I would not doubt for a second that he, if he's leading off, maybe take, but like try to see him a little bit. Like it's a 9-inning game, and obviously this guy won't be out there for 9 innings, but it's a game where the way you get to your starting pitcher, the starting pitchers, you get a feel for him. And a guy, if you haven't seen him, then you need to see him a little bit. And that's your job at the top of the order to do that. I think Vladdy's been very patient in that regard lately too, taking a first pitch a lot. Those are good things. Jano's got a very good eye, right? He's not afraid to kind of see some pitches. So maybe the first three hitters tonight can really size this guy up. And that, even if it turns out to be yet another 1-2-3 inning, then maybe after that first inning, you really gain a lot of knowledge. That's what's important to your other hitters, and that's what will be important the second time through as well. So maybe I hate to preach patience here because I don't like that word. I think that's what's gotten this Blue Jays lineup into a lot of trouble this year. But I think, you know, of course, aggressive when you do go for your pitch, but not being afraid, especially in that first inning, to see what he has and gain some information for the rest of the lineup as well.
When we last saw him, too, it was about a month ago now, but a very good Phillies lineup, and he nibbled a little too much, ended up walking, I think, 5 guys over 3 innings. So a guy who can lose the zone a little bit if he's trying to be too cute there. Joe, before I let you go here, you mentioned the move to Meza. It obviously, it doesn't matter that much when you score 0 runs. However, the fact that you turned a 3-0 game into a 5-0 game isn't great when you have a poor offense, and you still want to be making good decisions even if you end up losing a game. That call to go away from Trevor Richards for Tim Meza in that lefty-on-lefty matchup, even though, you know, Richards has been your guy for a couple years now, where you're like, yeah, we're okay with him pitching to lefties, and he's been, you know, significantly better than Meza this so far this season. What did you make of that choice?
Well, I think there are a lot of things at play here. Number one, I didn't like it because Trevor Richards has been very good, and I want to keep it a 3-0 ball game, and Tim Meza has been struggling. And when you bring the lefty in Meza, now here we go with those pockets again. That's the window. That's the pocket for Meza, right? Because he's going to get lefty, righty, lefty. How many times have we seen Tim Meza come into a game because two of the first three hitters he's facing are going to be lefties? Like, that's his spot in the game. And I just think it's forced sometimes. Now, Richards was pitching in his third game in 4. So that, to me, probably had a little something to do with it. They probably didn't want to push him too much. But that, combined with the fact that you've got Meza the lefty, 4, 2 out of 3 lefties coming up, that's where I think it does become forced a little bit. Now, the problem is because Tim Meza has not been Tim Meza, right?
Right.
Neither one of the lefties have been as expected and as we wanted to see. So that hurts, too. I mean, you're making decisions based on guys that are struggling. Well, that's not a lot of fun. It's like writing out a lineup with a bunch of guys that aren't hitting. Like, your hands are kind of tied when you're making these decisions. But I would, like, in that situation, I would have just somehow loved to see it stay a 3-0 game. And I think the best chance for that to happen was leaving Trevor Richards there. But again, I know they've got lots of rules with pitch counts and up downs and how many times guys have been in the game. But I think the fact that he was pitching third day in 4 games had a lot to do with it. But bottom line, too, is yeah, Tim Meza needs to be a lot better if this team's going anywhere else, because those guys in the bullpen that were so good last year, and we know Tim's been worked hard for the last few years. And who knows, maybe it's showing those signs, and it happens to guys. It's too bad for him because he's been so darn valuable to their bullpen.
Yeah, it's a tough spot when 6 of your 8 bullpen arms have an ERA over 4, you know? It's a tough way to go. And some of those guys will get back to being a little better here. Joe Siddle, one more down at Rogers Center, and then it's your homecoming weekend in Detroit. You're back on the call for those games alongside Dan Shulman. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, and enjoy Detroit.
Always fun, Blake. Thanks a lot, man.
Joe Siddle of Sportsnet, of Blue Jay Central. You can catch him with Jamie Campbell on Blue Jay Central tonight before the game, and obviously during the game. I was on with them last night, and yeah, I thought I laid out the Garrett Crochet case, and then he was even better than I expected. There was also, he did throw a lot of changeups last night. There was something I had suggested on that segment is, you know, the cutter has not been particularly good. He used it much better last night, keeping the Jays off balance, changing the velocity, and kind of went away from his more sweepery slider that's had some home run troubles lefty to righty. But he threw 13 changeups last night, which is a lot for him. And it was a pretty effective pitch. So bright days ahead for Garrett Crochet. I'm sure no Blue Jays fan wants to hear about Garrett Crochet ever again, though. It'll be Nick Nastrini tonight. Mentioned some of the stats. So it was originally supposed to be Mike Clevenger. They're going to bump into tomorrow. Nick Nastrini's coming up. He has a 7.88 ERA in the major leagues this year. That was just two starts. The Phillies hammered him over three innings. I'm not going to throw Nick Nastrini out as a player because the Phillies, the best team in baseball, got to him one time. But he also has a 5.83 ERA at AAA. Pretty decent strikeout rate. He's trimmed the walk rate a little bit at AAA, but historically, even through the minors, this is a guy that'll walk a lot of guys. I mentioned earlier, walked a lot of Phillies the last time he was up in the major league. So should be a guy this team should get to, but you have heard that before. We're going to keep the conversation going on the catcher side of things. Leo Morgenstern, who is a Toronto-based baseball writer who very rarely writes about the Blue Jays over at FanGraphs and MLB Trade Rumors and all around the internet, wrote a great piece on basically the death of the back pick. It's something we've seen Alejandro Kirk use in the past, fire it down to first base after a pitch. All across baseball, the rate of catchers trying to throw guys out on the bases behind a play is down. We'll take a look at that. We'll take a look at some other catcher stuff. And we'll talk some Jays. We'll talk a little bit of Phillies. We're back to 2 hours now on Jays Talk Plus. So we will be doing a little bit more MLB-wide stuff to mix it up. Probably less so if the Jays turn it around, more so if the Jays continue as they have been. This is a Jays team, by the way, that after the loss last night is now 21-26 again. That is not good. If you were wondering, this is, again, I've said this before, but this is the worst they've been since 2019 record-wise. They are still on the periphery of the playoff race, and there's a lot of baseball left, but you can't feel good about the fact that you've gone 8-16 over your last 24. That's a whole month of baseball where you've, you know, played at the level of the Chicago White Sox, and you're looking at today crossing your fingers you can take a series against the worst team in baseball and hoping that Chris Bassitt, who's been very steady for you, can get it done for you. We're going to take a break. Leo Morgenstern of FanGraphs joins us on the other side. Chris Black will be in the studio with us for the 11 o'clock hour as Jays Talk Plus 2 hours now continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Could be a long summer the way things are going. We're back to 2 hours, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. every day. Speaking of a long summer, here's a stat for you from our pal John Morosi. The Blue Jays have gotten zero home runs from the cleanup spot in the order this season. A little random because you get home runs from other spots, etc. But we know this team can't hit home runs. What is the context of a team not getting a home run from the cleanup spot for their first 46 games of the season? Well, according to MLB Network researcher Eric Ness, this is the first time it's happened to any team in Major League Baseball since 1997, and it's the longest drought at any point in the season in Toronto Blue Jays franchise history. So whoever hits cleanup tonight, probably Bo Bichette, a lot of pressure to break this drought. That is ugly stuff. So let's not talk about the Blue Jays quite so much for this next segment. We're joined now by Leo Morgenstern of FanGraphs, Just Baseball Media, MLB Trade Rumors, etc. Leo, you're everywhere, man. You're Toronto-based and a Phillies fan. So I'll start with that. How does that work out? You do way more Phillies stuff than Blue Jays stuff, despite being right here.
Yeah, well, Phillies are the family team, and that kind of has always superseded my love of my own home city. I grew up with the great Phillies of the 2008 World Series team, and that just kind of always sticks with you a little bit.
Yeah, the way you can play both sides here, by the way, I don't know if you can hear the studio audience is booing right now. You know, this is a Toronto station, you're a Toronto guy, etc. But you play the Roy Halladay card. I know that was a little after 2008, but the only time I've actually been to a game in Philly was chasing a Roy Halladay game when he was down there. I guess that's, I assume with the Phillies being a family team, you being a Toronto guy, that was a pretty cool couple years as well as a fan.
Oh, that was fantastic. I mean, getting to see Halladay play for the beginning of his career in Toronto was so special. And then getting to watch him be absolutely incredible in Philadelphia. I feel like I have a more special connection to him than most people. And I think a lot of people will tell you that, and I'm probably not as special as I think I am, but.
Look, we all have special Roy Halladay attachments. Some of us have little Roy Halladay tattoos as well. We all got Roy Halladay stuff here in Toronto, which is great. It's why he's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Blue Jay of all time. Leo, before we get into some of your Fangraphs work here, talking about catchers and pinch hit rates and things like that, I want to play a little quick game with you. This is the Ben Nicholson-Smith game. So you're not the only guest of Jays Talk Plus who does MLB trade rumor stuff or has in the past. Ben Nicholson-Smith, you can go way, way back to find MLB trade rumor stuff. Do you remember, and there is a tie-in, a slight, tiny tie-in to tonight's Jays game, so this is slightly on topic. The first thing you wrote at MLB trade rumors.
The first thing that I wrote at MLB trade rumors.
Yes.
Man, and you know, I sent it to my whole family. I was so excited about it, and I have absolutely no idea anymore.
This White Sox team cut Stephen Piscotty. That's your first one. Stephen Piscotty, who, by the way, is now in the A's, the Oakland A's minor league system. That's the last thing you did there. Or first thing you did there, rather.
Can't say it stuck with me, no.
Yeah, can't say Stephen Piscotty stuck anywhere after that either. So let's get to some of your more recent work that you'll hopefully have, this will be more front of mind. So over at Fangraphs, you wrote this great piece the other day. Catchers have been pickier about pickoffs. Now, this was last week. I went through and updated the numbers. There have only been 8 catcher pickoffs so far this season, and there are only 6 of those that are kind of the true pickoff, non-caught stealing type. That sounds like an okay amount, but you know, because you just don't see it all that often in the games that you watch, but we're not all watching 15 games a night. That is really low, and it's really off the pace of what recent history in baseball has been. What made you want to write that piece about catcher pickoffs, and what do you attribute the kind of decline of the catcher back pick to?
Yeah, well, I love looking into the kinds of things that you might not notice watching on a daily basis, because catcher pickoffs are so rare, even at their highest. Like in 2023, when it was a pretty normal year, I think we saw 51 of them over 2,400 games. So it's not something that you're ever going to pick up on unless you're really digging through the numbers, and digging through the numbers is what I love to do. And so I was just kind of clicking around, trying to find an interesting story. And this number really stuck out to me when I saw, at the time of writing, there had only been 7. Now we've had one more. Jose Trevino made a pretty exciting back pick a couple of days ago. But we're on pace for like half as many as we saw last year, half as many as we saw the year before, half as many as they were on pace for in 2020. And it's just a pretty shocking downturn. Even I felt like that was worth digging into, because it's not something we're thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
It's also one of the most fun plays that you can have, right? Like, and look, the cameras miss them sometimes, but that quick snap back down to first base or something like that, especially if you're at the park, that's a high energy play. We want to see more of those.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's one of those few plays that's so exciting. It's just as exciting in person as it is on TV. Like, it's just everything about it is so impressive, because we're talking about the athleticism of the catcher. We're talking about the agility of the catcher, but we're also talking about the catcher's ability to read the game and understand the perfect moment for one of these catcher pickoffs, especially because the risk of an error is so high on a play like this, and the risk of success, the chance of success is so low that the vast majority of times catchers throw down to a base, they're not catching anyone. And so it's a real mind game of, I have to find the perfect break-even rate before I decide to make this throw, but catchers are doing that in a split second, and it's just so impressive.
And look, one of the reasons this might be down is, you know, so nobody in baseball has done this more than once so far this year at the catcher position. Last year, Keibert Ruiz, he led the league, which is fascinating because he might be the worst defensive catcher otherwise in baseball. And he had like 6 of these. Like, maybe that's why he's so bad defensively. He's just like always ready to jump out of his shoes and throw down to first. So nobody's done a lot of those. Do you think a part of this, like the downturn in it, and look, the running game's up, so that tells me is like, okay, I'd be incentivized to throw down there a little bit more, but maybe pitchers are a little bit more aware. In reading your piece, kind of the thing that stuck with me most is maybe there's a trade-off where, because of this emphasis on catcher framing, we're seeing catchers move up closer to the plate a little bit more, which is leading to more catcher interference and bad injuries and things like that. Catchers are just emphasizing other things. Do you think that's a fair kind of first reason why these have declined?
Yeah, I think, of course, we're too early in to come up with a definitive reason and to find a data-backed reason. But definitely, if we're trying to take the common sense route, that seems like the most obvious explanation is that catchers are focusing on framing more and more than ever. I mean, I think teams have always known that framing was important, but over the past few years, we've actually got the numbers to show just how many runs a catcher can save with framing. Like if we look at Patrick Bailey from last year, who was good at everything a catcher has to do, but framing is far and away how we provided the most value to the Giants. And I think teams are probably realizing that focusing on framing is more important than focusing on other skills. And whether that means that framing and back picks are directly at odds with one another, or whether that simply means that when teams are practicing in spring training and when the catching coach is working with his guys, he's working more on framing than other skills. And that means that the other skills just aren't showing up in the game. It's probably a bit of column A, a bit of column B. I actually wrote a few weeks ago for FanGraphs about factors that affect balls right in the center of the pitches right in the center of the strike zone being called balls. And the number one explanation is when it's a wild pitch, when it's a pass ball, when the catcher jumps up for a caught stealing or a pickoff. And when the umpires don't get a good view of the pitch because of what the catcher's doing, they're far more likely to just call it a ball. So in fact, the actions that might lead to a catcher pickoff attempt are also more likely to result in a called ball. And if the catcher can actually get the guy on the pickoff, of course it's worth the risk of a ball. But if he doesn't, are you willing to risk all those extra balls piling up? Seems like probably not.
Yeah, it's a tough trade-off there. And then the other thing you could say if you're a catcher is, well, hey, pitchers, you guys got to do a better job controlling the run game. We are seeing pitchers try to pick off a little bit more, pick off a little bit more successfully. So maybe they've just shifted some of that responsibility. You know, it's almost a little unfair that catchers have gotten hung with the stolen base numbers for so long when we know that, like, the pitchers are a little bit more responsible for it. And now maybe some of that labor is just shifting back. Like, this is your responsibility, man. You got to do that a little bit. So one other note that I thought was really cool in your piece is that we have seen this year more steals of home than catcher pickoffs. Now, those things aren't like directly related, but they're both very rare events that are very, very cool to see. We saw another steal of home last night. The Red Sox pulled off the second base home plate double steal where you get the throw down to second and then the guy is safe at home as well. We saw the Blue Jays actually bait the White Sox into that and get the runner at home the other night. Slight uptick in steals of home. Maybe this is related to the stolen base environment, but this one seems to me is just like, let's keep it going. This is so entertaining to see guys try to take home a little bit more.
Yeah. And what I think is extra interesting about that is that a lot of the catcher pickoffs we have seen this year have been at third base.
Mm.
And I don't have the full data on which bases we've seen all the pickoffs at previous years. That's not something that's tracked so publicly. But just from having watched all of the catcher pickoffs this year, it seemed like a lot of them were at third, which makes me think catchers have been protecting home plate a little more often. You might expect that the back picks are to prevent stealing second and stealing third, and yet, I mean, and steals at home were up last season. Like it's such a tiny percentage of total steals that we don't really think about it in terms of the big effect of the new rules, but I'm pretty sure that the new rules definitely did lead to more stealing home than we've seen before, and it's happening again this year.
So another rule change that you wrote about recently, and this was a rule change a couple years ago, but we brought in the universal designated hitter. And we all had questions about what that would do to things like pinch hitting and the utility of those four guys that teams have on the bench and things like that. Pinch hitting in games with a DH. So I know that in your story, you specified in games with a DH, in games with a DH. We won't do that here. We'll just assume, everyone can assume for the rest of this conversation, we're talking about games with a designated hitter. Pinch hitting is actually on the rise. I guess this is maybe a case of it took a couple years for teams to figure out how to structure the bench, how to utilize the full-time DH. What do you make of having written that piece, the fact that teams are getting a little bit more aggressive with pinch hitters here in 2023 and then 2024 even more so?
Yeah, well, I think that the number one explanation for it is probably that teams have access to more data now. Just like I was saying with catcher framing, teams kind of realizing that framing might be more important than anything else a catcher can do. I think teams are using their extra data to try to find every possible advantage in batter pitcher matchups. And so where before the only advantage that they might have had to consider was we're going to bring a right-hander if they're bringing a left-hander. And now it's clear that teams are thinking so much more granularly. They're comparing bat angle and they're comparing okay, how does this pitch height match up to this guy's bat speed? And that would be my number one guess for why we're seeing more and more pinch hitting in recent years. I think obviously it also has something to do with rosters expanding, and when teams have that extra player at their disposal, they have more options to play the matchups. The real question that I kind of proposed at the end of my piece about that, and that I don't think we have a good answer to, is it worth it? Because there is a lot of evidence that suggests that pinch hitters come into a game at a disadvantage because they're coming in cold. The average pinch hitter is significantly worse than that same player would be if he was in the starting lineup. And if we're tinkering for the smallest possible matchup advantage, is that overcoming the pretty significant advantage of coming into a game cold? I'm very hesitant to say yes, but it needs a lot more research to come up with a good answer.
Yeah, it's a tough one because you can never use a control group, right? Like you can't play all these games out knowing, but you can look at some surface level numbers. Pinch hitters suck this year in baseball, and they always have. Yeah. Like if you pull data from 2002, and like we're talking about an OPS plus of like 86 since 2002 for a pinch hitter, that is not good. You would hope a guy coming in, you're putting him in, generally those situations are higher leverage, because why would you pinch hit in a situation that doesn't really matter? And you would hope you're getting at least average production. We're getting way below average even this year. Yes, league-wide OPS is only 700. That's not very good. Pinch hitters are at 642 and only 688 in high leverage spots. Look, there's some selection bias here too, because like your best hitter is in the lineup every day. They're not going to be available. Like, you know, Juan Soto might be available to pinch hit once or twice all season if he's got an off day. There's some of that, but also, yeah, it doesn't seem like numbers wise we make that good of use. It's funny. Like, I know pinch hitting such an interesting one because like it's been such a part of the game for a long time, and there are like old axioms that suggest when you know like platoon splits are 100 years old and things like that. But then we get, oh well, we have more and more data, so we should be even more efficient and effective with these. And it's like, oh, we're still really bad at pinch hitting. My guess is that it's just like at that point in the game too, you're facing relievers who are so hyper specialized and things like that. Maybe you'd be even worse without pinch hitting in those spots. I don't know, man. Maybe the Braves, though. Maybe the Braves have it right. Just, hey, here are our nine guys every single day.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was partly inspired to write that piece when I read about how much the Tigers were pinch hitting. They were really focusing on playing the matchups this year. And then I looked at their splits, and maybe they've gotten a lot better. This was from a couple weeks ago, but oh my goodness, were the Tigers terrible when they put a pinch hitter into the game. And it just doesn't seem like it's working out.
Yeah, they are not the worst team in the league, but they're hitting a .180 and slugging .220 when they use a pinch hitter. So that is, that's like you would almost not even pinch hit for your pitcher with those numbers, yeah. You know? Like those are, like Zach Greinke's career hitting numbers are better than what the Tigers are doing as pinch hitters. It's pretty bleak. The Yankees are even worse, actually. The Yankees never pinch hit, but they're hitting .133 with a .200 slugging in pinch hit situations.
It's hard to be a pinch hitter.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, want to throw some MLB wide stuff at you before we let you go here. I know you are a Phillies guy. Wrote a couple Phillies pieces recently. One on Matt Strom, one on Ranger Suarez. Look, the Phillies are the best team in baseball, so I don't mind going on the Phillies here on a Toronto show. They're 35-14. Man, Ranger Suarez, like, are we talking early Cy Young buzz here? He's been incredible.
I mean, he's doing everything right. Like, I mean, I've been a big Ranger Suarez fan for a long time, as I'm sure you can imagine. And he is he's been a guy who's shown significant improvements every single year. And obviously what we're seeing right now is an incredible step beyond that. And I'm a guy who likes to say, let's go with the much larger sample size of data from several seasons rather than what we've seen over 7 or 8 weeks right now. But I mean, he was last night again. I mean, he's just so good every single time. And he's starting to convince me that he can't do anything wrong. He's got so many pitches and he knows how to use every single one of them effectively. I think this is a guy I think a lot more people have to be paying attention to. Seems like all-star appearance is almost already locked up. So I'm excited.
Yeah, that would be exciting. Sub 2 ERA this far into the season. Pretty, not even sub 2, 1.36 ERA now through 10 starts. Ridiculous. High ground ball rate, high strikeout rate, low walk rate. He's checking all the boxes there. And then he turns the ball over to a bullpen that is overall not that good. The Phillies bullpen is 23rd in bullpen ERA. But you look, and Jose Alvarado is Jose Alvarado at the back end. You've got Jeff Hoffman, old friend here in Toronto, who's figured it out as an elite setup man. Orion Kerkering, who is like the stuff guy. And a guy you wrote about yesterday, Matt Strom, from the left side, who has an ERA under one and almost two strikeouts per inning. How confident are you in that Phillies back end, even though the overall numbers aren't that great?
Yeah, the ERA is pretty high, but I mean, every single other number you can look at for the Phillies bullpen, and they're doing the right things. So I'm certainly confident that their bullpen is only going to get more effective. There's a handful of guys at the back, the guys you didn't name, who I have a little more concern about, like Gregory Soto and Sir Anthony Dominguez. But I mean, even those guys, we've seen them at their best be so dominant and they throw so hard that we get a little regression to the mean with the Phillies ERA lowering. And maybe if we also see some of the guys struggle and start to figure things out, and Phillies could easily have the best starting rotation and the best bullpen in the National League. And I understand that I'm a biased source, but I believe it.
Here's someone you're not biased on. You know, I would imagine Phillies fans don't love the Pirates. I'm looking ahead a week here, but because you wrote about him, because he's incredible, the Paul Skeens experience so far, we don't know if the Jays are going to get him. I'm certainly keeping an eye on those probables, because getting to see Paul Skeens up close in Toronto in like his fourth or fifth major league start would be unbelievable. What have you made of his first two starts here?
I mean, this is a pitcher we've never seen anyone like before. I mean, to be throwing that hard and to be throwing that many pitches and going deep into games while throwing triple digits, it's just, it's not something that we have any precedent for and not something we really know how to understand. And I think that it's going to pose an incredible challenge for opposing hitters to be facing heat like that from the very beginning of the game instead of just like inning 7, 8, 9. And it's also going to be really fascinating to see how the Pirates kind of handle him and make sure that they're keeping him strong and keeping him healthy, because he's so young and he's throwing at a level that, yeah, there's no comparison. There's no way to say this is how we treated this player before and kept him healthy. There's no answers. And so it's going to be really fascinating to watch, but he's just so unbelievably talented that I'm really excited and really hope he keeps doing it for a long time.
Yeah, the only really anecdotal comparison that comes to mind is Steven Strasburg when he first came up and the Nationals had to juggle, well, we're headed for the playoffs. What do we do with them? We got to, you know, look long term. The Pirates probably aren't heading for, you know, World Series contention this year, so they could be a little more careful with him and Jared Jones. Skeens is ridiculous. So he's thrown 74 fastballs over his two starts, 99.7 average velocity. And oh, by the way, I throw four other pitches too. I remember watching him against the Buffalo Bisons in AAA earlier this year, and he broke off a curveball for like the first time. I think it was the first time he'd used one this year, and like him and his catcher were just like laughing because the curveball was nasty, and I forget who the hitter was, but was absolutely not expecting it. An embarrassment of riches for Paul Skeens. Leo Morgenstern, man, thanks for taking the time out, buddy. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk.
Leo Morgenstern of Fangraphs, Just Baseball Media, MLB Trade Rumors. A lot of fun stuff there on what's going to catching. Catching is such a fascinating thing to me. Just the amount that those players have to keep in their head and balance between the framing and the blocking and controlling the run game and hitting. So that's why, you know, when we talk about Danny Jansen and Alejandro Kirk's workload split, like Kirk's only started five times in May. And we're, what, May 22nd? I know the Jays have had a bunch of off days in there, but he really hasn't played a ton. Does that help his bat because he's a little fresher? Maybe. And maybe that 2-1 split becomes something that works for both Kirk and Jansen. You know, maybe, look, a lot of this is the bats are going to dictate it. Overall, at least defensively, the Jays have gotten what they've needed out of that spot. They haven't been the best team controlling the run game. They're 43-50, or opposing teams are 43-53 stealing bases on them. But based on the Baseball Savant, the Statcast data, we can see that's a lot to blame on the pitchers. The Jays catchers actually come out close to neutral. I know it doesn't always seem that way because some of the throws, you know, those late tails, Kevin Biggio making a great tag to save a stolen base and things like that. But they're okay there. They're also number two, the tandem there, number two in blocking and number seven in framing. So in addition to Danny Jensen's bat, Jay's getting a lot defensively out of their catchers right now. We are going to get an hour out of Chris Black in the second half of this show at Down to Black on Twitter. He had some good threads this morning. You can go check out before we bring him in as Jay's Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Programming note, we are back to 2 hours for the rest of summer now, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. J.D. Bunk is still in the 9 o'clock slot, but let's get him a breather after a long Raptors/Leafs season. He'll be doing 1 hour for the rest of the summer. Blair and Barker, by the way, are in the 4-6 slot now. You would have gotten familiar with that last summer and earlier this week, but as a reminder, that's where they are. They will also, as usual, be coming at you with Jay's Talk postgame. For most games, Shawali will have it covered when they don't. One other programming note, we're going to try something new on Jay's Talk Plus this year, and we're going to try it starting tomorrow. We can't do live callers on the show. I know people with sports radio, they want, that has been something we do as sports radio for a long time. Because this show is simulcast on TV, we can't do live callers. However, producer Ahmet Mahn has figured out a workaround similar to what Blair and Barker do. We got a voicemail line. So tomorrow we're going to try a mailbag segment where you can call in and leave a voicemail, question, comment, rant, whatever. Keep it radio friendly. Make sure you include your name and location. That number is on the screen there if you're watching on TV. If you're not, it's 416-413-4116. I'll read that out again at the end of the show, and I'll tweet it out later as well. So you can get involved. I'm thinking we'll do that every Thursday. Blair and Barker do it on Fridays. Thursday tends to be an off day most commonly. So, we'll give it a shot and we'll see how that goes. Pressure's on you guys to have good questions and be charismatic, energetic speakers. Speaking of charisma, a man dripping with it, Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, at Down to Black on Twitter, joins me in studio for the second hour here. How we doing, buddy?
There's a reason why I work primarily behind the camera, because I'm not the most charismatic guy, but I'll do my best for this 1 hour.
I also have heard recently the chatter around the Blue Jays is that you, maybe it was a one-off, maybe it was just one bad day. Maybe not the best golfer, but Buck Martinez whooped you a little bit recently.
Buck Martinez is a very good golfer.
Shocker.
Full disclaimer, he lives in Florida, so gets a lot of rounds in. He doesn't have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old at home. No, doesn't have those limiting factors. So yeah, the most dispiriting loss that I've seen or experienced in the last couple of days was not yesterday's Blue Jays game. It was when Buck and I went out to Coppinwood, which is like a track like 10 minutes away from my house. It's awesome. They always take good care of us. Caleb Joseph plays there from time to time. And Buck, it was his first time there. He loved it. And he whooped me pretty good. Approximately, I want to say like 10 strokes.
Okay.
Probably, but Damn. He's good. He's very good. I played the whole round. My win is I played the whole round with one ball. It didn't help me score,
okay,
but I played the whole round with one ball.
Yeah, I mean, you could do that if you only used your putter the whole course, too.
No. But listen, I'll take my little victories where I can get them.
Buck strikes me as a, 225, 240 straight every single drive.
He's very consistent off the tee, and he can putt. Buck can putt. And he's the worst part. There's a lot of cool things about playing with these former athletes. I've been lucky enough to do it from time to time. But it's really frustrating, how coordinated they are. They don't make dumb mistakes. They can all putt. And I am not a pro athlete. So, yeah, it can be a little discouraging at times, but always entertaining.
Who is the best pro athlete you've played with before? Or, who had the best round when you were playing with them?
That's a good question. Caleb Joseph can hit it.
Yeah.
A mile.
Okay.
He's tall and he's athletic, all that stuff. Morneau's got the bug big time.
Okay.
He's been playing a lot and he's gotten really good. I haven't talked to him recently, but I feel like his cap is probably in the single digits now. So okay, he's gotten very good. But I am not a single digit cap right now.
Yeah, and then if we're talking active players, apparently Ernie Clement's the best one.
Yeah, apparently Clement can swing. Apparently Schneider can play as well.
Davis, okay.
Apparently.
I'd imagine John Schneider can hit the ball like 300.
Yes,
but,
he's got that. Yeah, got that dad strength. So I'm still looking for that. But.
All right. The reason we've spent 4 minutes here talking about golf is because the Toronto Blue Jays are not very good. They lost again yesterday. They got shut out. Let's start with that. I want to do some higher level stuff with you. You had a great thread on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. the other day, and you came on with us in one of the early episodes of Jays Talk Plus this year, and we did a lot of Vlad stuff. So worth revisiting that. We'll do a lot of the kind of bigger stats stuff like we normally do. But I do want to start with a couple things from last night's game, starting with Garrett Crochet, who was nasty. You tweeted out his sub-1 ERA and sub-1 whip over the last five starts. He's a guy on Blue Jay Central last night. I kind of broke down, like, this 4.18 ERA coming into this game is fake. Like, he is way, way better than that. What did you see from him? What did you like from him in that game?
What I saw was, like, kind of a trend from league-wide, but just because you're playing a bad team doesn't mean you're not going to face a great pitcher from time to time. It's just they don't necessarily have the amount of good pitchers that good teams do. And he was nasty. Like, that stuff was really, really good. And this is baseball in 2024. Even when you're facing the worst team in the league, doesn't excuse the way the Jays have hit all year long. But that guy was as good as any pitcher you'll see all year. Like, the stuff that he brought to the mound, and I get that tip your cap has become a hashtag, but he was really good. And again, like, that's as good of a pitcher. That's, you know, but that's Mackenzie Gore on the Nationals. That's Cole Ragans on the Royals. Like, there are these guys on every team now. There's a guy who's pumping 97, 98 from the left side with a nasty breaking ball, whatever. Like, it's really, really good. And as I said, like, you're going to face it from time to time. And that's why, like, when these soft stretches of schedules come up, like, you almost need to not educate, but, like, a 13-game win streak isn't happening. Like, those things, like, yes, they do happen very, very rarely, but you got to hope for 9-4, 10-3, something like that. They do need to take care of business. They do need to catch up. But it's like, this is what baseball's like. From time to time, you're going to run into a buzzsaw.
And to be clear, this does not excuse the Blue Jays' performance. Every team faces tough pitching. The Jays are still 29th in runs per game. They are actually dead last since the start of 2023 in run value against high velocity from lefties. So guys like Crochet particularly get to the Blue Jays. We've also seen them perform in the bottom 10 this year against those kind of high spin fastballs like Crochet's have. Now, they've seen more of the righty type from that. Crochet's also got a weird one where it's not the kind of active spin, it's more like the gyro spin, and it's turning like kind of like football wise a little bit more than a standard fastball. But either way, that high spin stuff the Jays have not done well with. We will talk about the Jays' struggles. I did want to use the Crochet as a jumping off point for where league-wide offense is. And you had a thread on this morning on Twitter at Down to Black. League-wide, OPS is under 700. It's 699. That's the lowest since 1989. Teams are hitting 240, which is the lowest since 1968. Man, we were supposed to, like, they have been changing the rules to try to help hitters, try to help base runners a little bit. We still can't buy any offense high level. Like, obviously this is, the pitching is so fantastic and the hitting hasn't caught up. But what do you make of that at a more, you know, practical level?
Well, you hit on it right there. Like, they did some things to try to help hitters. Like, the shift rule was meant to help hitters. I even mentioned, this is a very small thing, but it's something we've all noticed. Anyone who works in the game, who covers it, you're noticing scoring, even like in terms of scoring decisions.
Yes.
Plays that would have been marked as errors a few years ago are being marked as hits more often now. I think that's, is it a league-wide mandate? Is it just people? I don't know.
We have heard from people who have said, like, people who are in the industry and have scored, and they've been told, yeah, 50-50 is a hit.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and anything close, you got to give it.
Yeah, and I don't even, like, it's not even something I, like, mind all that much. It's like, yeah, did you get on base? Sure. Like, there are some glaring errors, but, yeah, if it's 50-50, mark it a hit. But, so, again, even with that as a factor, even with the shifts as a factor, hitting is still kind of going downwards. It's getting harder and harder to hit. So it's been kind of shocking to see this year, like, seeing the numbers continue to go down. I do think some of the rule changes they made over the past few years have been like, hey, pitchers, throw it in the zone more. Like, don't nibble, attack hitters, and we'll see more action. And I think we're still waiting for that next shoe to drop in terms of the hitters balancing it out a little bit.
Yeah, and pitchers are always going to be, not always, but they're probably going to be a step ahead. And we can look at this like analytically, you know, the analytics stuff that is coming to the game is a little more advanced on the pitching side. We know more about pitching. We can do things like pitch modeling and the things that pitchers are doing in the offseason to improve pitching in a way that hitters haven't been able to catch up yet. The tech's not there, or the numbers aren't there. And there is a capacity to human athletic performance that, you know, maybe you're just never going to be able to be that good against 100 regularly and these sliders with nasty break. There's also an element of, and this is something you pointed out in your thread, this is maybe something that is actually actionable for the league. Pitchers getting further and further off the mound when they're pitching. Now, that's legal the way things go now. It's a sign of great athleticism. If you're one of those tall guys that can extend really far down the mound, still plant and get your velocity off, not injure yourself. That's another thing a guy like Garrett Crochet does really well, 6'6", and gets way down the mound so that this ball is getting released closer and closer to you. Is that one you could see the league coming back with a little bit and being like, hey, you got to stay a little closer to the rubber or stay on the rubber a little longer through your delivery?
I'm convinced this is like a really, really big factor.
Okay.
But I don't know what the solution is, to be honest. Like, this is pleading my ignorance on this one. Like, I don't even know what the rule book says in terms of, does the rule book say you need to be in contact with the mound when you release the baseball? I don't know. But all I know is that in less than 10 years, so we're talking, I think from 16 or 17 to now, the average extension for pitchers has gone from 6 feet to 6.5 feet. So they've gained they're releasing the ball on average 6 inches closer to home plate than they were just 7 or 8 years ago. So, there are some extreme versions of this. There are some pitchers who literally, it seems like they're jumping off the mound, getting down the mound before they release the ball. There are guys on the Blue Jays who do this. So like, I don't know what the solution is, but I think that would like instantly help. I wrote on Twitter that I was watching an old Dave Steeb broadcast, and who's one of the best pitchers of his generation. And when you watched him release the ball, his back foot was in contact with the mound when he released the baseball. So the fact that, like, I would even suggest that it's probably a foot greater than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So it's extreme right now, and I just don't know how you enforce it. I don't know how you kind of make pitchers go backwards, but I just know that it's like, I think it's a really big factor, and it's pitchers are already throwing harder when you add in added velocity and closer to home plate. I think it's, again, hitting is very, very difficult, and I think we're seeing that league-wide. I know the Blue Jays are towards the bottom of hitting so far this season, but just league-wide, I think it's harder than ever to hit a baseball.
Yeah, and the rule is technically that pitchers only have to be engaged with the rubber while taking their signs, and then you get into, like, well, there's umpire discretion around, like, quick pitch and like, did you disengage and things like that. But technically, yeah, you just have to, while you're taking your signs, and then you can kind of do whatever you want. Obviously, there are extents to that where, you know, if you stepped down the mound and threw from flat ground,
yeah, like
it would be a disengagement.
And it needs to be a natural motion and all that. But yeah, I honestly think if they change that rule tomorrow and every pitcher had to be in contact with the mound as they release the ball, I think batting averages would go up like 5 to 10 points right away.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about like perceived velocity and what that does, right? So if anyone hasn't heard us discuss it before, you know, think of the example. This is the example I use. It's a little morbid. You walk out into the street and there's a car coming and it's going 60 kilometers an hour. And that car is 5 feet away when you step out into the street versus if that car is a kilometer away, that will still be the same impact. It's still a car at 60 kilometers an hour, but you have a lot more time to read that and decide and make a reaction to it. If a pitcher releases the ball 8 inches closer to you, especially when you're talking that speed over that short a distance, that is, you know, a dramatically different. So when we say, hey, that guy's fastball was 98 miles an hour, but the perceived velocity on it was like 99.1. That's what we mean to in terms of a hitter and the reaction speed they need. So some of these like 99, 100 are playing up even higher because guys are getting so far down the mound. I guess the other thing with this. There are two other things I thought of reading your thread. One is obviously the automatic balls and strike system comes to mind, because that not only does it probably give a couple extra strikes back to the hitters over the larger sample, at least based on the data that we can compare AAA to the majors that we have, but also the strict definition of the strike zone maybe helps hitters a little bit more. Just you don't have to defend against borderline stuff as much. You can trust kind of what you're seeing.
I think what it would do is it would create a kind of repeatable, predictable zone, as you said, for the hitters. And that's so much of hitting is, and that's partly what I said about why hitting is harder than it is for pitchers to kind of improve and use it. As a hitter, you can improve your swing and look at high-speed cameras and fix some technicality, but there's still the unknown of where's that pitch going to be, what kind of pitch is it going to be, is the ump going to call it a strike or not. So if you could control that one factor, if you could train yourself to know that electronic strike zone as well as you can, that eliminates one kind of unknown factor behind you where you can do everything right. And this is where, like, this is where you see modern hitters get frustrated when they take a really borderline pitch, a 90, whatever, 2-mile-an-hour slider from a really nasty pitcher just off the edge. They do everything right, and then some ump calls it a strike. That's where you see that frustration. It's like, damn, I did that right. I should be rewarded for that decision, but I'm not. So if you made that repeatable, predictable, all that for hitters, again, something that I think, and we've seen, as you alluded to, like AAA hitters, it's kind of, their on-base numbers are up. Like,
yeah,
you kind of need to take AAA numbers with a grain of salt right now because of that electronic strike zone. But if you brought it up to Major League Baseball, again, if you brought that up tomorrow, I think you'd see on-base numbers go up almost overnight.
Yeah, and it's not just the walks. It's being in more hitters' counts and things like that, counts where you can do damage and be aggressive and things like that. Things the Blue Jays have done a good job of getting to and not a good job of executing in. So maybe it wouldn't help the Jays all that much, but it might help offense around base. But there are some other stuff too. You know, we've seen people kick around, well, what if you shorten the number of bullpen arms you're allowed to have so that starters are incentivized to throw softer and go longer? Joe Siddle tweeted out in response to your thread, you know, a limit on pitch velocity. I think the union would probably push back on that and be like, no, if our guys want to risk their arms to throw 101, we're not going to get in the way. If you didn't do automatic ball strikes, you could do something with where the catcher positioning, where they're getting, it seems like they're getting too close to the plate now. We've seen catcher interference spike significantly. We've seen arms getting broken. The reason catchers are doing that is because it's at least the data says you do a better job framing if you're up closer to the plate. You could trick the umpire a little bit more that way. So maybe you can make some changes like that. For the Toronto Blue Jays, those changes aren't coming anytime soon. Those would be changes for 2025, 2026, well beyond. They got to figure out how to do this now. They've got to figure out how to do this against, tonight it's against a guy like Nick Nastrini, who we don't know much about. We haven't seen a ton of. Last night they couldn't get it done against Garrett Crochet. We've seen them not get it done against a lot of teams and a lot of pitching so far. We can look at, so I'm going to set you up for this. I want to talk about the overall roster construction and the offensive construction on this team. I want to start by asking what you make of, and we can have some fun with the new bat speed stuff. I'm in the camp right now. I think it's more fun than helpful right now while we figure out what's what and learn, you know, hey, Luis Arraez has slow bat speed and he is one of the really good contact hitters. Isak Paredes has one of the slowest bat speeds, but he's so good at pulling the ball in the air down the line, it doesn't really affect him. So I think we're still in the process of contextualizing a lot of this stuff. But when you are 30th in bat speed as a team, that certainly stands out. What did you make of that? And what do you make of this bat speed and swing length stuff that we have generally in the early going here?
I think it's been really cool to see all the different smart people who work around the game and cover the game post their work, post their initial thoughts. Mike Petriello, the guys at Baseball Savant and MLB, have done an amazing job rolling it out. I think it's like pitch velocity. There are outliers. It's, pointing out Luis Arraez can be successful is the same as pointing out Kyle Hendricks could be successful when he was at his best, you know. But all other things being equal, more pitch velocity is better than less, and more bat speed is better than less, all other things being equal. The other big takeaway that I'm seeing is on an individual level, on a team level, there are A swings and B swings.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing that a lot of people are kind of quickly realizing is that there are, you kind of see it, if you look at it in a graph, nerdy way, there's like two kind of waves when you're looking at a distribution of people's swings. Yeah. So there's their best swing and their not best swing. There's a contact swing and a power swing.
A two-strike swing and a hitter's count swing.
Yeah, but even before, like that's the other big takeaway is that I don't think there's almost any value in looking at swings as a whole. Like I think you got to look at two-strike swings as one thing and pre-two-strike swings as another. But even pre-two strikes, I think there's A and B swings. And I think a perfect example of that was last night. Bo Bichette, his first at-bat of the game, he lines out, first pitch. It's kind of a pitch on the edge of the zone. You kind of would say, oh, he swung at a pitch at the edge of the zone and got himself out. Is that a bad swing decision? Is that? But I loved it. He was committed. You could tell he was looking for a fastball. He swung the bat hard. I think it was a 78-mile-an-hour swing. 75, for context, is hard swing. He hit the ball hard. He lined out to center. I think that's a good swing decision. He was committed. I think that would have been classified as his quote-unquote A swing.
Yeah, he was looking for a fastball, clearly.
He got it. So it doesn't need to always be a pitch middle-middle because those pitches aren't always coming. But later in the game, I think it was seventh or eighth inning.
Well, there were two later in the game because he gets up in the fifth and he swung at a bad slider too. He just kind of rolled over it for a ground out. But the one you're talking about is the 0-0 slider that he chases in the seventh.
Yeah, like it. I don't know. Again, hitting I preface all this stuff with hitting is incredibly hard.
Yes.
But so it was a pitch that was outside of the zone. He swung his B swing. It was a 60-something mile an hour swing, and it was a lazy line out to center field. Now, same outcomes, but drastically different swings. And one of them I'm fully on board with. The other one is a poor swing decision, in my opinion. Now, was he looking fastball and just kind of altered his swing once he realized it was a slider? Was he looking slider and altered his swing once he realized it was going to be out of the zone? But that's one of those things where you'd almost be happier with swinging as hard as you possibly can at that pitch, whiffing, missing by a foot, and be 0-1 as opposed to that lazy fly, right? So I think that's the part that we're learning is like there is a benefit, and I think team-wide, to bring it back to the Blue Jays and that 30th in average bat speed, like some of that you're not going to be able to change. If your collection of hitters and their max swings, there's an upper limit. There's a threshold that they're not going to pass. If those are the hitters you have, like you can only maximize so much. But I think what we've heard kind of reading between the lines from this team over the last couple of weeks is maybe they can get to those A swings a little more often earlier in counts. So it's about swinging harder more often before two strikes. Again, two strikes. Strategy
survive.
Changes,
yeah.
Survive. But I think pre-two strikes, it's about can you get to those A swings a little more often?
And it's something that we've heard John Schneider kind of allude to, the fact that, you know, when we talk about, you've made good swing decisions, you've got yourself in good counts, now you have to do a little bit more damage on that. We've heard John Schneider talk about that. We talked to Shai Davidi on Monday. He had a piece on the Friday when they almost got perfectoed by Tyler Alexander, where he talked to Matt Hagg, who's one of the hitting coaches. And that was, you know, one of the things that Matt Hagg was going into. And Hagg, it's worth noting, was with the AAA Buffalo Bisons last year, works with a lot of the younger guys on the team, the guys who are having a bit of success here. So a voice worth listening to possibly there. So yeah, the Jays come out in 30th in bat speed, and that, you know, it's helpful information. They're also like 29th in runs per game, which is the most useful information we could probably get. I know like a lot of this discussion about this has been that some of this was predictable. And I agree that some of it was predictable. We came into the season and I thought that they would be an average offense. I didn't think they had done enough to address the offensive side of the ball. But obviously, like, I find me the person who thought they'd be the second worst offense in baseball. What do you think that, looking back, once they miss on Shohei, and it was a fascinating offseason because I did add the letters at the end of the season with Ben Nichols and Smith, and we laid out what the offseason could look like, and it was really unsexy. And that was plan A. And then the Shohei stuff happened, and all the potential went way up here. And then when Shohei didn't happen, to not only adjust to your initial offseason outlook, but they didn't even hit on the best version of that initial offseason outlook, it has been tough optically. It was tough emotionally to kind of ride that. And it's obviously been tough in the results so far. What do you think they could have done differently once they missed on the Shohei thing to be in a better position than they are right now?
There were two game changers in the offseason. There was Shohei and could you trade for Juan Soto? Now, I don't know. I'm not tuned in enough, plugged in enough to know whether Soto was ever an option. But once those two are out of the mix, there's no game changer that changes the offense. Is it Cody? You know, what would Cody Bellinger look like in this lineup? Assuming it, but that likely means no Turner. And I know Turner's been in a rut lately, but
he's also Turner. We're probably going to have to talk about at some point, maybe just being the weak side of a platoon more often than not, at least if Jansen's requiring a lot of DH days.
But you look at all those options outside of Ohtani, where it's Cody Bellinger, it's Matt Chapman, JD Martinez, those types of guys. If you bring them in as opposed to a Turner, does this offense look much different? I think there's only one decision, you know, if you reverse back, knowing if you knew that Springer was going to struggle the way he's struggling, if you knew that, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if you go down the line, you know, do you lean more offense in terms of filling out that outfield spot instead of Kiermaier? Of Kiermaier, right? Now, I think it's simplistic to say if you sign Teoscar Hernandez, he brings 11 home runs and 40-something RBIs to this lineup.
I mean, yeah, you can't transport RBI. Yeah. You can maybe transport home runs a little bit because that's a hitter and a swing and stuff. But, yeah, you can't be like, well, that's 40 RBI because you wouldn't have had those guys on base.
You don't have Shohei and Freddie Freeman and Mookie Betts hitting in front of you. So I think it's simplistic to argue that Teoscar's production in L.A. would have been exactly the same.
No, but we could say it would have been better than what they've gotten offensively out of those spots. And the names you mentioned, you know, like they wouldn't change the overall conversation of this team, but JD Martinez has hit better than any of the guys that the Blue Jays brought in. Matt Chapman, after a very cold start, has hit much better than Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Cody Bellinger has hit much better than Justin Turner and Kevin Kiermaier. Now, all of those guys were more expensive as well, so there are other trade-offs there. But yeah, it's a tough spot.
I think it's micro. Like, I think you're bang on, but I think it doesn't change, as you said. Like, yes, it would have been a little bit better, but it doesn't change the fundamental issue of Springer, Bichette, Guerrero, Kirk, down and down. They all need to hit more.
Yes, like the guys who were going to be on this opening day roster, no matter what you did in the offseason, have all underperformed, except for maybe Dalton Varsho, who has cooled off dramatically.
Yep.
We will talk about Dalton Varsho cooling off after the break. We'll also talk about Vlad picking it up, at least in terms of contact hitting. Didn't have a hit last night, but still seeing some okay process stuff. His month of May has him at almost 400 and almost a 500 on base percentage. So at least from the contact hitting and the getting on base perspective, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. started to turn things around while Dalton Varsho has cooled off a little bit. We'll explore those two trends. We'll take a look ahead to game 3 of Jays Sox tonight after the break, as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Nick Kiprios.
And I'm Justin Bourne.
We're diving deep into everything happening in Leafland and the biggest stories around the NHL.
Real Kipper and Bourne, weekdays from 4 to 6 on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, sitting color, playing us back in for our pal Chris Black. A little Cuff the Duke earlier, a little Oshawa.
Oshawa? Yeah, they were awesome. From the, like, I mean, when I used to go out and listen to live music like 20, 25 years ago.
This is back before we had analytics.
Right? Yeah, this was a while ago. They used to play, they were like Blue Rodeo. They used to open for Blue Rodeo all the time, kind of an alt country kind of thing. Saw them at Hillside and Guelph a few times. And then they always used to play the Horseshoe. And I used to live fairly close to the Horseshoe for a few years. So they're awesome. And any chance I can get to rep Oshawa, I will do so.
Of course. I mean, look, we did it with Dizzy last year. Yes. They ended up on the broadcast a bunch. So yeah, if they put out new stuff, we'll run it back and we'll sneak 100%. Them on the broadcast as well. Okay. Talk about some Blue Jays stuff. Again, mentioned it before the break, that Vlad has kind of trended in the right direction, at least from a contact hitting and on-base perspective of late. Still not seeing a lot of power stuff. Dalton Varsho has kind of gone the other way. He did have that big homer in Monday's game, but over his last 11, we're talking about a 551 OPS, just a 143 batting average, and a lot more strikeouts. So let's start with Varsho, try to diagnose this a little bit. And I start there not because it's better to be negative than positive, but you have a great thread on Vlad up, so that if we don't get time for Vlad, people can check out the thread. What are you seeing with Varsho cooling off a little bit here, sliding back down in the order, particularly against lefties?
The best way of describing Varsho is the way Caleb Joseph describes him from time to time. He's a collision hitter. So he's going to run into things, and it's a simplification, but if he can run into X amount of baseballs per week or per 2 weeks or per month, if he winds up at 25 home runs and a above average OPS plus or WRC, whatever you want to call it, then that's what it's going to be. Like, he's going to go through these ruts from time to time where he swings and misses a bit. If pitchers execute pitches, when he got off to a good start, it was him hitting mistakes. It was him taking advantage of pitchers making mistakes. And you will go through stretches as a hitter where, as we said in the first half hour, hitting's incredibly hard and pitchers don't make a ton of mistakes to you. And if you miss the odd one, if you don't take advantage, then all of a sudden you'll have an 11-game stretch where your OPS is 500 or something. So I like where he's at. I like where he's going to wind up. This is a quick aside, but like, if we get, I know we're still a few weeks away, but like, will the Jays have a position player? Like, can you really vouch for a guy hitting 210 to be an all-star? Like,
the big question is going to be, does Danny Jansen have enough games played at that point for people to consider
maybe,
him for all-star?
Maybe, but it's probably going to be the pitchers,
clearly
right?
Been their best.
It'd be like Kikuchi and Barrios right now.
Yeah.
But it's, because he's been probably, there's Tucker, Alvarez, and Judge. Like, so after those guys, he's probably like, and Soto, I guess, but like, he's probably like the fifth best outfielder in the AL so far, maybe top five, top six. So I don't know. I've been happy with him. Yes, again, there's going to be peaks and valleys with his type of swing and how hard he swings, but I like where he's at, and I'm not terribly concerned. What have you seen?
Yeah, so he's seventh, by the way, in wins above replacement among American League outfielders.
Yeah, that feels right.
Tucker, Soto, Judge, Jaron Duran, who part of a double steal of second at home last night, which is as much as I'm loath to credit Boston teams, especially after last night. That's really cool. And then Stephen Kwan, who's hitting 353 up ahead as well. But then it's and Colton Cowser's right in the mix there, too. It's very, very American League heavy. Jerks and Profar is the only National League outfielder in with those other seven guys there at the top of the outfield leaderboard. Weird one.
Yes. Early on this, but it's just pointing out that he's been good. The defense has been as good as advertised this year, and it's my level of concern meter when it comes to, if you're comparing him to other Blue Jays, is pretty low.
Yeah, and look, the better other guys hit, the easier it'll be to take those Varsho ups and downs, because if he's hitting seventh in your order, it's not that big a deal, right? Like, a guy hitting seventh for you who's in there to run into some home runs and has, look, it takes me a little bit to get there with a guy who is going to be on base about 300. Right? Like, that's not a great clip. There was a stat I love is his 2022 season was like, he was very close to being one of only a small handful of guys ever to be worth 4.5 wins while having a sub 300 OBP. It's hard to be a super productive player, but you run into enough, and then obviously the base paths and the defense are pretty tremendous. So I think it's one of those things where, like, yeah, if Schneider and Jansen at the top of the order works for the time being, if Vlad keeps moving in the right direction, I won't be sweating the Varsho stuff that much. It only looks a little more extreme right now because they were trying to hit him high in the order because he was the only guy
out
hitting.
Out of necessity.
Yeah, he's the only guy hitting for pop. I actually wouldn't mind. I used a stat earlier that John Morosi posted, which is that the Jays don't have a home run yet from a cleanup position. Against righties, I actually don't mind Varsho in that spot. That moves Bo down to number five. I don't mind that as a look as well, though. Again, these things, the batting order stuff tends not to matter if guys aren't hitting well.
Yeah, I think Schneider hitting leadoff is by necessity right now, too. Like, personally, my favorite Blue Jays order is if Bo gets right. Like, I like Bo 1 and Vladdy 2. I want my two best hitters.
Your two best hitters hitting the most.
That's what I want.
Ideal.
Like, that's right. Like, you can, but I'm not, and that isn't me disagreeing with the lineup now. Like, they're doing what they have to. They're doing as, like, production matters right now over everything. So I just think the best version of this team is one where Bo is hitting, he's right, and you're getting Bo and Vladdy, the most plate appearances that you absolutely can.
Yeah. Bo, we talked about kind of a, not a rough night for him, but certainly at least one bad plate appearance last night, arguably two. He had been a little hotter over the 10 games prior, five extra base hits, 981 OPS. You know, Bo, I think everyone maintained a confidence level that he was eventually going to start turning things around. Hopefully that'll continue to move in that direction. Now, with respect to Vlad, we have seen it's been 20 games plus now where Vlad has turned it around from a contact hitting and on base perspective. Before last night, over his 20 prior, he was hitting 397, 470 OBP, 963 OPS. Really good stuff. Not striking out all that much, 99th percentile in hard hit rate, all that good Vlad stuff. Where, and I know you had this great thread going into more of the Vlad details, some of the positives we're seeing. So you can hit us with some of those. But as you round out of those positives, why aren't we, and when should we expect to see this also resulting in more extra base hit stuff? Because I think even when Vlad, like, look, it's great that Vlad is hitting 397 over an entire month right now. The Jays need runners on base desperately. A lot of those have been really well hit singles that score runs and things like that, but eventually they're going to need a little power production as well. So where are you seeing where Vlad's at over the last couple of weeks?
One of the biggest markers or things I look for to see when guys are going right or wrong is how are they taking pitches? It was one thing a couple of years ago when you and I were talking every week, we saw it was a prelude to the best stretch of Bo Bichette's career was the way he was taking pitches. That's what I'm seeing from Vladdy right now is the way he, the term we use is the way he spits at pitches on the edge of the zone. Like he's either A, seeing the ball very, very well out of pitcher's hands, or B, having a really good idea of what pitchers are going to do even before the ball's out of the hand. It's probably a combination of the two, to be honest. So I like those things a lot. And I think process like that is usually a prelude to things, to everything else that we are looking for, to the power, to everything else. With Vladdy, I firmly believe that like the worst stretches we've seen from him in his career is when he chases home runs, is when he tries to get big, is when he tries to get the ball up to left field. Like that's when we see bad swing decisions. That's when we see strikeouts. That's when we see ground balls to left field. So I think this hopefully you keep this process and you run into a few more, you catch a few mistakes and you start seeing those home runs. I think it's going to come. I think the good stretch has been even longer than what Jen just had up on the screen not too long ago. Like he's a 300 hitter dating back to like after the first six or seven games of the year. He's been a 300 hitter. He's been a 390 OPS or on base guy. Like, again, we need to see more power. We know that. But I like the process. I think the good process will lead to home runs. And I think that's always been who he is, a good process guy, a 300 hitter who will run into home runs. And because he's so strong, because he swings the bat so hard, he'll run into 25 or 30 home runs. That should be who he is. Now, there's something going on. We talked last year a ton about why are these, when he pulls the ball, why is he hitting these top spins?
Yeah.
Is that limiting the home runs? Again, there's a lot going on with it, but I like this process and I'll take the 400 on base for now if eventually we get some more home runs.
Yeah, and I think there's also some element of it is that when he does hit home runs, it tends to be to the deeper parts of the ballpark, so they just don't get there as often and things like that. But yeah, that's not on Jennifer. That's on me, the stats that I put up. Well, I mean, they're getting them out of, Jennifer and Ahmed are taking those out of my notes. So I just looked at the last 20
good
game
teamwork
window here.
It's all a team-wide production.
Yeah, so again, we're looking at, you know, he's chasing outside of the zone less, he's swinging and missing less, he's hitting the ball harder more often, you know, taking more walks and things like that. So you're confident that it'll come around from a power perspective eventually. I guess what that takeaway, and it's a reasonable one, and we saw it happen at times over the last 2 years as well, what that requires kind of accepting is that, you know, the 2021 version of him was absolutely an aberration. And if he is going to be a 25, 30 home run hitter who hits, you know, maybe 280, 285, something like that, that's a really good hitter. But the recalibration should stick at this point, that 48 home runs is probably going to be a one-off.
It's for now, that's what they're showing us, right? Like yeah.
He's on pace for like 14 right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, like so. You can't argue exit velocity like as the be all and end all. So yeah. Production matters, but it just feels like if he can settle into being, and 300 hitters are hard, they're very rare these days, but if he's 325, then that's a valuable hitter. Like if it's 280 and 20, like I don't think that probably works for a 12-year, $300 million contract or whatever that is, right? Like there's a certain threshold you need to hit at. And we've talked about this before. If you're a first baseman that doesn't run super well, like you have a higher threshold for what you need to do offensively. Yeah. So Vladdy is graded on a curve. He does need to hit for power, but I think this is just me saying, I think it's going to come. Like I think if you're hitting 150 mile an hour line drives all over the place, eventually those are going to turn into home runs.
Yeah, I mean, look, they might at some point. There's also the O'Neill Cruz of it all, where he's there's like you look at the Statcast stuff over time, and it's like okay, there's Giancarlo at the tippy top, and then Giancarlo Stanton. Then there's Vlad and Aaron Judge kind of in their class ish of their own, and then now O'Neill Cruz is coming along. Be like, I gotta bust all this stuff up. By the way, I'm not hitting super well either, but I'm gonna have these monster exit velocities. And like we've talked about, like I know people get their defenses up about exit velocity or whatever. I think it's well established at this point that none of us believe that is the thing you're chasing and the only indicator on its own. Direction, launch angle, just watching the way the ball comes off the bat, like it's just a helpful proxy and an encouraging sign when you're hitting the ball harder than anyone in baseball.
It's hard to be Paredes, right? It's hard to be low bat speed, just pull the ball every time. Like it's effective, it's efficient, but it's very hard to do. All other things being equal, as we said in the first half hour, bat speed, pitch velocity, exit velocity, all other things being equal, hitting the ball harder is better than hitting the ball less hard.
Yes. Not everyone can just do the old slow pitch single bloop it into shallow right field.
That was my game plan when I used to play as a teenager.
Yeah. There's two types of slow pitch singles, by the way. There's that one that just like, I'm going to bloop it into right field. Sometimes that's even a slow pitch double
you
if you're a fast person.
You can't go for singles in slow pitch, can you?
I mean, if you're not a home run hitter.
No, that's cynical.
One is the like, and George Springer almost had one of these yesterday. It's the when you like foul it off and it hits the board and it just rolls into that dead space between the pitcher and the catcher. But because it's beer league slow pitch, the pitcher and the catcher are not athletic enough to make a play
ruthless.
On that.
Just
yeah.
ruthless.
Yeah. If you could do that every time, you would have a 1,000 batting average.
I didn't have power, but no, if I was playing slow pitch, I was swinging for the fence.
Yeah.
You have to.
There are a few feelings as cool as hitting a home run. I haven't hit a ton of them, but it's a pretty cool thing. And maybe the Blue Jays will hit some. Sometime soon. All right, we got like 8 minutes left. We're going to do a couple quicker ones that we won't go as deep on. Chris Bassitt is on the mound tonight. He'll face the Chicago White Sox. Last year, midseason, he was having a lot of trouble with lefties. And you pointed out that he had changed up his pitch mix around the midway point, and it started being a little more effective against lefties. He is back to having that trouble. They have 6 homers against him already this year, weighted on base average well above 400 against him. Now, this is a bad game to use as an example, because the White Sox are 29th hitting against righties. They're dead last in terms of how their lefties hit against righties. Gavin Sheets is really good, but Benintendi, Lopez, and Fletcher are all awful offensively so far this year. Sox of it aside, what are you looking for from Chris Bassitt to kind of get back on track against left-handed hitters?
Chris Bassitt is like, I don't know him. I don't talk to him all the time, but he really seems like one of the smartest players in the game, pitchers, hitters, whatever. Like his stuff isn't great. We kind of know that. We've established that. Like there's nothing dominant about his sinker, but he might have, at least this was heading into this year, like he generated more outs with that sinker than almost any other pitcher with any other pitch type over the last few years.
I believe it's a top 10 pitch over the last couple of years in terms of run value.
And it's all the other stuff. It's kind of like, it's kind of smoke and mirrors feels insulting, and I don't mean it in an insulting way. Like, it's really impressive what he does without elite stuff. He did a couple things different last year to help against lefties. He started throwing that cutter instead of trying to throw it inside to them, started throwing it up and away. I think he found that a lot of lefties have that kind of hole in their swing. I just think with him, it's some of the pitches are going to get hit. Those breaking balls in that kind of the horizontal breakers, sliders, sweepers, even the cutter. I don't think those are great pitches against lefties. I like that he's been throwing more of the split and the change a little bit against them. I like that big loopy curveball. I like it as a get over strike early in counts, but I also like it to just mess with their timing a little bit. It was a couple starts ago where I was producing a game that he was pitching and he threw a lot of those. So I like that pitch as well against lefties. I think he'll figure it out. And as you said, I think this is, you know, we're not, this won't be the litmus test in terms of whether he's figured it out.
It'll be the litmus test if Benintendi and his sub 500 OPS go off.
Yeah.
You know?
But this is a guy who he'll go through again because the stuff isn't overwhelming. He'll go through stretches where he'll get hit a little bit, where either just the pitch mix is off or he leaves a couple out over the plate. He will get hit. But he's a guy I have like a ton of confidence in figuring stuff out.
What did you make of the Trevor Richards out for Tim Mesa decision last night?
Blue Jays lefties relevers, primarily two of them. But there was also Little was up very briefly. But they've been the worst performing lefties as a reliever group in baseball this year.
Mason Flaherty, ready, buddy.
But I bring that up only to say like, I have more confidence in some of the righties getting lefties out than I do in those two guys. Yeah. So Richards for sure has like those neutral splits or no splits essentially because of that changeup. Jimmy Garcia has been awesome, but he's obviously later in the game. But even like, I like Zach Pop against lefties. Like until those guys figure it out, like, I don't think you can force those guys into spots. Joe Siddle always talks about the pockets, but also you need to use them at some point. Yeah. Like, that's the weird part. You kind of need to use them somewhere.
Well, they're going
to
use Tim Mesa for sure. Here's another interesting question. Bowden Francis and Chad Green are both expected to get in the Buffalo Bisons afternoon game today. If all goes well, that's the last rehab for either of them. So two spots in this bullpen are going to have to open up. Nate Pearson and Zach Pop are the last ones in. Yenesis Cabrera, Eric Swanson, Tim Mesa all have options as well. I don't think Mesa's going anywhere. Swanson would probably be a phantom IL stint before it's an option down. But Pearson, Pop, Cabrera, do you have a lean of which two of those you think would be outbound?
Pearson's ERA is like 14 in the month of May. So he seems like a natural fit right now to go down for one of those spots. The weird part about the lefties is, if Mesa were pitching well, I think it'd be more likely to send Cabrera down. Like, you'd be more willing to have one lefty if you knew that he was nails and really shutting guys down. Like, I think almost the fact that both of them have been ineffective somehow makes you have to keep both of them up. Like, I know that feels like reverse. The logic feels off there. But, like, I think it feels like it's going to be Pop, but I don't know. Like, it might be an IL thing. If it were me, I'd probably lean Cabrera.
Yeah, I think
because
so.
I think he's been ineffective. And again, because I like some of the righties getting lefties out. I'm in the Trevor Richards fan club. I've been early on that. Like, I was early on that and I stuck with it through some ups and downs. So like, I like him against lefties. I like him in leverage, like use him a lot. I think he's also a guy who can get you four or five outs, which I think is incredibly valuable in modern bullpens. So I'd probably lean Cabrera, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was Pop or an IL stint for someone.
Cabrera, it's worth keeping in mind too. While he has been good for the Blue Jays, he was available for free last year. This is a guy who had been designated for assignment because of the persistent control issues, despite the quality of stuff. Last one here, we've only got about a minute. Ernie Clement got a hit yesterday. He's one of the two Blue Jays who got a hit yesterday. He had been not playing as much and not playing quite as well of late. He changed his walk-up music yesterday. Shout is out. He went with The Sweet Escape by Gwen Stefani and Akon. The Jays have been, as a team, very consistent with their walk-up music for years.
Like,
guys do not change their music much. Are you in favor of a guy mixing up, change the music up if you're not feeling great at the plate the last
mix
little
anything
bit?
Up to help. If you do, you change what you're wearing, high socks, low socks, gloves, no gloves.
Ernie also had only one pant leg yesterday during warm-up.
100%. Like, change anything you do. Batting gloves, no gloves. Glasses, no glasses. Pine tar on the helmet, no pine tar on the helmet. Music. Like, I was at the very low levels that I played sports at, I would change anything if something was off for a couple games in a row. So, yes, Superstitions matter. Feeling good in your head matters when you're up at the plate. It's a very hard thing to do to hit a baseball. This is what we've established. So change anything that makes you feel good at the plate.
The placebo effect is a placebo effect, but it is real.
It's real.
Measurable in studies. It has an actual impact on you. Chris Black at Down to Black on Twitter, sports producer. Thanks for taking the time out today, buddy.
Anytime.
All right. This has been the first 2-hour edition of Jays Talk Plus. Back. We'll be 10 to 12 every day. Blair and Barker, 4 to 6 for you now. And they'll do Jays Talk post game, of course. As a reminder, we're going to do some call-ins tomorrow, but you have to leave a voicemail because we can't do it live. That number is 416-413-4116. I'll tweet that out as well. It's Chris Bassitt against Nick Nastrini tonight. Nastrini, 788 ERA over two starts earlier in the year and a 583 down in that Charlotte bandbox at AAA. 93-94 with the fastball and a slider to righties, changeup, curveball to lefties. Thanks to Chris Black for coming on. Thanks to Joe Siddle and Leo Morgenstern for joining us as well. Thank you to Amit Mann, Lance Kennedy, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. The Jeff Merrick Show is coming up for you. We'll talk to you with your calls tomorrow on Jays Talk Plus.